Chapter 35.
During the days just before Dorothy Kilgallen died, she was quite concerned over there being leaks of her JFK assassination investigation evidence to the wrong people. The strongest instance of this topic being discussed was related through Mark Sinclair's recollection of speaking to Kilgallen on Saturday, November 6th, 2 days before her death. In his videotaped interview, he stated, "We talked for about an hour. Her life had been threatened. Finally, I said, 'The only new person in your life is Bo Pataki. Why don't you ask him if all this information that is slipping out about you is coming from him?' Because she was concerned where people were getting the JFK assassination information from. After exhausting me over what was going on, I'm the one that suggested that she confront Bo Pataki with it. I called him Bo because that's what she called him. And she was dead after that, 2 days later." Of note is Kilgallen calling Pataki Bo. There is no certainty as to why this nickname was selected, but in French, Bo means beautiful. In English, the word means boyfriend. Pataki was deemed handsome and a hunk by most everyone who knew him. But Kilgallen, obviously infatuated with her new young paramour, apparently believed he was beautiful, perhaps a beautiful boyfriend. During a separate audiotaped interview, Sinclair said, "Dorothy was worried about dying." Asked if this was when she was considering buying the gun, Sinclair replied, "Yeah, that was 2 weeks before she died. And then the Saturday before the Monday she died, and we discussed it for hours on the phone. And that's when I said, 'Well, what about Bo? You know, we'd narrowed it down to just about everyone we could think of that was harassing and threatening her. That's the only time I took her seriously about dying. And of course, it was much too late. Up until then, I didn't think anyone could touch her.'" Unfortunately, Sinclair was not asked to provide details about who everyone was and the means by which those people had been threatening and harassing her. Phone calls, letters, personal contact. He recalled that she did say, "You know, I have had threats on my life." And when he asked by whom, she simply replied, "People." The only time Kilgallen ever specifically referred to those who were threatening her. After they discussed who might have been leaking her JFK investigation information, and Sinclair mentioned Pataki, Sinclair said, "There was a long pause, and then Dorothy said, 'Maybe.'" This account explains why he had previously said, before all this with Pataki started to bubble over. Sinclair, who stated he saw Pataki at a distance once at P.J. Clark's, but never met him, said, "Strange things were afoot after the New Orleans trip." Commenting on that trip, Charles Simpson declared as noted, "She had obviously dug up something about the JFK assassination that someone didn't want her to know." Interviews at the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. Pataki denied Sinclair's account that Kilgallen had confided in him about her JFK assassination investigation. "There's a lot that Dorothy didn't tell me. Clearly, she didn't want to worry me." This comment conflicts with Pataki's previous statement that Kilgallen spoke with him about Jack Ruby, the main focus of her investigation, and was angry while doing so. Pataki added, "Dorothy danced around problems. She did not want to tell me, for example, that she'd had death threats." This statement triggers the question as to how Pataki knew of any death threats if Kilgallen did not share the threats with him. Concerning Kilgallen's frame of mind about Pataki, as November 8th neared, Mark Sinclair had a definite opinion. In his interview, he said, "I would imagine that she was upset about Bo Pataki. I think he was the snitch. She was telling him so much about the JFK assassination investigation, and that's that." Kilgallen's friend, CBS producer Marlon Swing, was also suspicious of Pataki, stating, "Here was a new man in her life, one suddenly romancing her, and prompted by somebody, not necessarily himself, but by some faction." The latter word, the same one author Israel used above. During his videotaped interview, Mark Sinclair stated, Yes, I think Pataki knows who killed Kilgallen. I don't think he did the actual work, but whoever his employers were did kill her. If this happened, if Pataki was monitoring Kilgallen, he knew she was too close to the fire, too close to exposing those threatened by her JFK assassination investigation evidence. He surely would have known Kilgallen planned another trip to New Orleans in November to collect further evidence important to her continuing investigation. It's also logical to believe she told Pataki that she was connecting Oswald and Ruby based on what she learned at the Ruby trial, and in addition, both men, to Carlos Marcello. If Pataki divulged this secret to the dangerous people who could have decided to recruit him to snitch on Kilgallen, a plan to eliminate her may have been set in motion, especially since she knew of the discrepancies between what Ruby said happened before he shot Oswald, what the Ruby trial transcript testimony revealed, and what he had told her during his interviews with her. Pointing a finger at Ron Pataki as the one most likely to be the mystery man Kilgallen met during the early morning hours in the Regency Hotel bar seems quite plausible. Who else can it be that Kilgallen was sitting close to, as described by Catherine Stone? Pataki was the only one Kilgallen was dating, the only love interest in her life at the time, since she and Richard were at odds and Johnny Ray was a past romance. Those closest to her, including Mark Sinclair, Charles Simpson, and Bob Bach, never mentioned her being infatuated with another man aside from Pataki. Of great interest is that during the years following Kilgallen's death, no one has ever acknowledged meeting her in the Regency bar a few hours before her death. There would have been no risk in doing so unless the mystery man was instrumental in causing her death. The potential Pataki was the mystery man, the one betraying her, recalls Mark Sinclair's statement that he suspected Pataki was responsible for strange events happening during the few weeks prior to her death. If Kilgallen took Sinclair's advice to confront Pataki regarding these strange events, then it is logical Kilgallen contacted Pataki and voiced her concerns. He, in turn, may very well have telephoned her at home hours before she appeared on her final What's My Line program, and the two argued, upsetting Kilgallen. Recall that Brenda DeJordan stated, "My father told my mother that something happened earlier that night prior to her getting home, that Dorothy was upset about something." When the shifty Pataki telephoned Kilgallen after she confronted him, she could have demanded Pataki meet with her later. This could have given him an opportunity to dissuade her from believing he had been leaking information about her JFK assassination investigation. Common sense signals, despite his denials to the contrary, that if Kilgallen summoned him, Pataki obeyed, or perhaps he was already in New York City, even at the Regency. If so, all he had to do was leave his room and meet her in the hotel bar after midnight. Whether Kilgallen knew it or not, the Ron Pataki she had fallen in love with at the time was not simply a mild-mannered entertainment reporter and columnist from Ohio. Instead, before he met her and afterward, he had a history of unruly behavior and violence, dating back to at least 1954, with each episode connected to excessive alcohol intake. During his only year of attending Stanford University before he flunked out, Pataki's disturbing actions, those of a drunken college student, were noted in an article in the Stanford Daily. The date was May 26, 1954, with the copy reading in part, "Student Harry R. Havens, 19, was one of the three men arrested yesterday morning for an incident at the Greyhound bus depot in Palo Alto. Havens, freshman Ron Pataki, and sophomore Tony Serra were placed under arrest and later released on bail. Havens booked on a charge of possessing a faked operator's license, Pataki for drunkenness, and Serra for malicious mischief." The article then summarized the incident. According to the bus driver's statement, the students demanded to board the bus at 12:38 a.m. When he refused because they looked drunk, One of them began hammering on the windshield with a wine bottle. The driver, Jack Pierce, went to the station's phone booth to call the police, but found that the receiver had been ripped from the wall. This incident has been verified through this author's interview in March 2018 with Tony Serra, today a highly respected, legendary San Francisco attorney, who represented, among others, Black Panther's co-founder, Huey Newton. As I recall, we wanted to go somewhere away from Stanford after a night of drinking vodka straight from the bottle. Serra, 83 years young with a gleam in his eye, stated, I believe I met Pataki when we both played on the freshman football team, the Indians, now the Cardinals. According to Serra, the three drunks were in a gay mood and demanded that the bus driver let them on the bus, but he refused. I remember being upset and pressing my body against the front of the bus window, but the part about banging the wine bottle against the windshield, I just don't know, he said. Then the bus driver opened the door and said he was going to call the police. Hard to believe now, but I went to the telephone booth and ripped out the receiver, maybe the whole damn telephone, while Pataki and Havens watched. When the police did arrive, I hid between two buses, and Pataki hid under a bus, but they found us. Whether Pataki's conduct caused problems with the law over the next few years is unknown, but according to a front-page story in the Columbus Evening Dispatch on December 5, 1963, less than 2 weeks after the JFK and Oswald assassinations, and 7 months before Kilgallen began an affair with the journalist, Pataki was once again in trouble. The headline read, Pataki arrested. Slugged, he says. Party with actress Anna Maria Alberghetti at friend's home ends roughly. Beside the article appeared a photograph of the two holding hands. The article's opening paragraph read, Ronald A. Ron Pataki, 28, theater and movie critic for the Columbus Citizen Journal, claimed Friday he was beaten and manhandled by police officers after he accidentally cut his head at a friend's home Thursday morning after a drinking party. The Columbus home of jazz band leader Alvin F. Waslone was noted as the location of the confrontation. Pataki was quoted as saying, As we, he and Alberghetti, were leaving, I slipped on a rug. I hit the glass on the door. It broke and I cut my head. Concerning the allegation that he was beaten and manhandled, Pataki said he entered the police vehicle quietly, as an injured man being taken to the hospital for treatment. Police officer Charles West told a different story, that he and another officer had to subdue Pataki and that West gave him a black eye after Pataki threatened him and used foul language. The report also quoted a duty patrol at Riverside Hospital, who, when asked if Pataki appeared to be intoxicated, said, Oh, brother. Officer West added that Pataki had apologized, explaining that he was emotionally upset because of some disagreement with Miss Alberghetti. Several accounts alleged Pataki was an attractive man who had relationships with several beautiful young actresses, but they were short-lived when they realized he had a drinking problem. There was one disturbing encounter when Pataki, apparently inebriated, picked up a table and threw it across a room. The police were called by the actress, who refused to provide her name but was pegged as an Italian beauty, stating, Something in Ron's brain clicked when he drank, and he went bananas. She added that Pataki admitted previous instances like that one, including his having rammed his car into 5 others. The Italian beauty turned out to be Alberghetti. She recalled Pataki being intoxicated and violent and nutsy, while confirming he had thrown the table, causing the police to arrive. 6 years after Kilgallen died, in April 1971, a bizarre incident happened, confirming Pataki's violent tendencies. According to a front-page article in the Columbus Dispatch, his victim was National Football League running back Jim Otis. The disturbing account occurred during a time when Pataki was attempting to handle public relations for the Columbus Police Department. On its front page, the dispatch reported, Suburban Upper Arlington Police are continuing their investigation of conflicting stories in a shooting incident involving a theater editor, Ronald Pataki of the Columbus Citizen Journal, and James Otis, former Ohio State University and Salina High School football star. Police reported that no one was hurt in the shooting and that no charges have been filed. Several shots had been fired at Pataki's residence early Tuesday. Pataki reported to police that he and Otis had become involved in an argument. Otis, now a Columbus restaurant owner and member of the Kansas City Chiefs professional football team, told police that Pataki threatened him with a blackjack and that four shots were fired at him as he left the editor's house. Pataki also told police that Otis had fired a shot at him. A follow-up article sported the headline, "Pataki Faces Pistol Charge." It read in part, "Ronald Pataki, Citizen Journal Theater editor, was charged with discharging a firearm Tuesday after he admittedly fired four shots after a ruckus with former Ohio State football star Jim Otis. No charges were filed against Otis, 22, of 5026 Durker Road. Otis left the house with a blackjack, which he said he took from Pataki. As he drove off, Pataki fired a .38 caliber pistol four times. Although Pataki told police Otis fired once at him, police did not find a weapon in Otis's possession. Neighbors reported hearing four shots. Of note is that Pataki was carrying an auxiliary police badge, permitting him to arrest people while his appointment to handle public relations for the police department was pending. Based, it would seem, on Pataki's irrational behavior, police officials revoked his temporary badge. He did not become the police department's PR representative. Later, Pataki told a close friend he had been a policeman. Untrue. Pataki's possession of a gun and a blackjack is quite alarming, with his having attempted to kill Otis even more distressing. From the official account of the incident, it also appears Pataki lied about Otis having shot at Pataki. In early May 2018, this author interviewed Jim Otis, 22 years old at the time he and Pataki had trouble. "The incident you mention with Pataki is not quite as glamorous as I remember it," Otis said. "I don't remember too much about any shots being fired or any blackjack, but I do think I called the police." He added, "Pataki was a funny guy, different. Not a guy I would have wanted to spend any time with. He wasn't about anybody but himself. Maybe he made up part of the story, I don't know. But some friends of mine in Columbus chewed me out for even being around Pataki, since he had a reputation as a guy who got in trouble a lot." Yet another disturbing incident, this one in the late 1990s, provides an example of Pataki having completely lost control of his life, that he appeared to be a lost soul. According to records secured by this author, it happened in Westerville, Ohio, 15 miles north of Columbus. The Blunden Township Police Department arrest information, prepared by patrolmen John Watt and P. Cromwell, charged Adam Ronald Pataki with operating a motor vehicle impaired and disorderly conduct. Accompanying the form were the details of the arrest. On October 3, 1998, at 4:30 p.m., police officers were dispatched to Blenden Hall Motel Room No. 5 on a very intoxicated man who refused to leave and he would not pay bill. Officers arrived, spoke to defendant, who was very intoxicated, unable to stand on his own, urinated clothing, defecated in pants, unable to care for himself, no money. Also, he would not comply to officers several times to get his belongings. The defendant had a good warrant for his arrest from Columbus for OMVI, $5,000. He was then placed under arrest, transported to FCJ, slated. The warrant was designated as OMVI, or operating a motor vehicle impaired, or drunken driving. At the time, Pataki listed his employer as Waffle House for 6 months. The patrolman said Pataki told the officers he was a cook at the restaurant. He was wearing a soiled restaurant uniform at the time of his arrest. According to court records, Pataki, who listed Christian as his religion and the motel as his home address, was rendered guilty on July 23, 1998. He had spent 20 days in jail and was given credit for time served while being fined $200 with $100 suspended. Note, on April 25, 2018, an email was sent by this author to Pataki that included the arrest report. He was provided the opportunity to comment, but declined to do so. Whether Pataki ever drank to excess, or had similar bouts of irreverent conduct when he courted Kilgallen, and whether she ever witnessed his violent side during the considerable time they spent together, from June 1964 until she died, is unknown. Quite likely any dark side would have been hidden from view. The sad incident in Westerville having happened in the late 1990s triggers the question of whether Pataki's attempt to cleanse his soul and wash away the strange behavior and drinking problems years earlier was successful. In the spring of 1992, he completed classes at Reverend Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, earning a master's degree in a Christian counseling program. This was followed by further education through a PhD program in Christian counseling from Trinity Theological Seminary, a conservative evangelical Bible college and seminary located in Evansville, Indiana, a year or so later. Whether Pataki earned the degrees by being on campus or through online learning is unknown, but regarding the latter, he immediately began referring to himself as Dr. Pataki. Had guilt over Pataki's complicity in Kilgallen's death caused the need for the Christian cleansing? Had Kilgallen's ghost haunted him during the dead of the night? The bizarre account in Ohio 5 years or so later is cause to believe the journalist, who had been fired by his Columbus newspaper in 1980, was still infested with demons.